We usually talk about wildlife in the cities with Daryl Jones from Griffith University. Today we're going to talk about a not-so-loved wildlife from one of his colleagues, Gail Spina, also from the Centre for Innovative Conservation Strategies at Griffith University. Gail, we tend to regard Indian miners as pests and problems. How big a problem are they?
The main issue is the fact that they nest in hollows, and with our native species being very reliant on hollows, I think it's something like 1 in 5 of our Australian native birds require hollows to breed in, and then you add to that a lot of our bat species and our possums and our lovely little squirrel gliders and our native bees. There's a lot of competition for hollows as a breeding resource, and adding to that the rate that humans are chopping trees down, that competition for the hollows really escalates. And the minor birds need the hollows to breed, but they'll use any hollow at all. They're not too fussy, and they'll defend their hollows very, very successfully. They're very aggressive birds during the breeding season, which leaves our poor native wildlife at a bit of a disadvantage, particularly given that many of our species like particular hollows. They're a bit fussy. They like it north-facing, or they like them with a particular diameter opening, or they like it with a particular length of drop to the bottom of the hollows. And when they get faced with a mob of angry miners saying, no, this is ours, not yours, sorry, and winning the fight for the hollows, or alternatively, even coming in once, say, a pale-headed rosella is nestled in with its little chicks in the hollow, the miners will come in and throw out the chicks and take it over. So they're not even averse to taking over a hollow that's already used.
How often do they breed?
Normally they would have at least one. Two is not by any means unusual, and three in a good season. So if you have 2 to 3 chicks in each brood, let's say only 2 of them make it, in theory, one set of parents can become 8 birds at the end of a breeding season. Miners find a tree which has multiple hollows, or perhaps multiple trees with hollows, and they'll move in as a group and defend it as a group. And that's the difference. They pack, essentially, and they'll defend hollows that they don't even need, because they tend to move into an area as a breeding site and they'll think, there's only 3 pairs but there's 5 hollows, so we'll just defend those other 2 hollows because in future seasons they might come in handy for us.
How long do they live?
Most species that are these quick breeders don't have very long life spans. I'd say 5 years would probably see them out. That's a guess. I'm happy to be challenged on that.
Now, this is apparently one of your research interests.
Yes, the main area that we're looking at is the fact that up here we don't have quite the same numbers that you have down there, which is why we're very keen to find out as much as we can in that early emerging population stage, because we figure if we can find out why they choose some areas to settle and not others, we can get in early and try to keep the population numbers down.
So this is a recent invasion for Queenslanders?
Relatively recent. There have been some areas where they've been for quite a long time. Certainly in North Queensland, up in the cane fields, where they were actually imported up there on purpose to try to control the cane beetle. That didn't work. But as far as southeast Queensland goes, the numbers are really quite low at the moment, but expanding quite rapidly, unfortunately.
I've always thought of them as some kind of a horrible invader. It never occurred to me, of course, that they're gorgeous birds who probably do have a great social interaction.
One of the things that makes them so successful and why they do get to the numbers that makes people think of them as horrible little invaders is that they are very adaptable and they're very aggressive. And one of the things that enables them to take over the areas that they move into is that they work very effectively together. They communicate very well with each other. They've got a lot of calls for things that are safe, things that are dangerous, things that are good food. They have very strong routines. The same birds seem to go to the same places every day, possibly in the same groups. We haven't really established that yet. When they come home, they roost as one big group. Before they go into that roost, they won't go in until a particular bird tells them that it's safe. They won't come out of the roost or leave the roost for their daily foraging until particular birds tell them that it's safe to go. So there's a lot of these social patterns that help them to invade areas and make the most of the resources that are there, find the good places to feed, find the good places to roost, and most importantly, find the good places to nest. And when they found those places, they work together to defend them and to muscle out the local native wildlife.
Does that mean they're not particularly migratory birds? If they find a nice place, they'll just stay there?
That's very true. They will stay in the same area for a very long period of time. A lot of people think of them as urban birds, but in their native India, they're called the farmer's friend because they hang around those farming areas and feed on pests, which is why they like them there, and certainly why they were brought out here to do exactly that. If they've got everything they need, which they do in a lot of farming properties, they're quite happy to stay there. But obviously, if they start breeding up successfully, there gets to a level of population pressure, they need to disperse. And why they choose to go where they go and why sometimes they don't get to that level, they tend to keep their population down, they're the sort of questions that we're asking here now.
If they were introduced in relation to the cane, does that mean they were introduced into Queensland? And if so, why have we got such a problem with them down here in Sydney?
Their first introduction to Australia was 1862 to handle the pests that were decimating the Melbourne Market Gardens, which was, of course, the main source of food for the new colony down there. And they did a wonderful job. Sydney then asked, please send us some up here, which they dutifully did, and they did the same diligent work up there. And then the cane farmers up in North Queensland said, that sounds good to us, send them up here, and maybe they'll handle the cane beetle. They have the same problem as they did with when they opted for the cane toad. The cane beetle tends to hang around the top of the cane, and the minor birds are essentially ground feeders. So they didn't like the cane beetle, but they did like the climate up in North Queensland and decided to stay, and their population has really exploded. But they didn't move down south. Now, a lot of the reason for that is, we think, they don't like travelling over bush. They don't like bush at all. They're very much a bird of the environment that man creates. The nice open spaces and mown grass. They breed in tree hollows, so the trees that are left standing because they're the old growth trees, the ones that we like to leave in our parks and our golf courses, they're left there with the hollows in them, and the miners say, thank you very much, we couldn't get to them before they were in the bush, but now we can. But a lot of those places, like North Queensland and Sydney and Melbourne, were relatively isolated. There was still a lot of bush surrounding them, which prevented the miners moving out to any great extent. But probably post-war, 1950s onwards, when there started to be much more road networks and much more suburban development in regional areas as well as the metropolitan areas, we've actually created pathways for the birds to travel. And this is what we're seeing up here in Queensland. They're starting to move down, and they're starting to move east from the Toowoomba area, and they're starting to move up from New South Wales, of course.
So once again, it's man who's really created a wonderful environment for them.
Absolutely perfect. We are providing them very nicely with all the resources they need to survive. And really, it's the reason that they are so successful, because they work well with us. And the International Conservation Foundation released their top 100 most invasive species. The minor bird was one of only two birds that made that list.
Does your research involve trying to control them?
That's always the difficult question. When you explain to people why they're a problem, the next question's always, well, what can you do about them? And unfortunately, we don't have a good answer for that. They're very clever birds. They're very crafty. Nothing seems to work more than a few times, and then they learn to be wary of it. When you're looking at a control mechanism, it has to be specific to that species. I mean, it's no good killing off all the miners if we kill off a number of other species as well. So it's finding that method that will target minor birds and only minor birds and is reliable, and it's just proving a little difficult. And that's where I think from the research that we're doing up here, it would seem that perhaps looking at the importance of their social systems and their behavioural systems may well be their Achilles heel.
What do you mean by that?
Well, if you can disrupt their communications or if you can predict their patterns of movement, then you've got much more chance of getting in early or perhaps creating environments that are a little less attractive to them, or even predicting where they will go so that when they get there you're ready and you can target resources, pest management resources or control resources much more effectively. Because a lot of birds who rely on a social system to survive, if their numbers fall below a particular number or if their communication can't happen the way they want it to happen, they will stop breeding. And we're thinking that maybe that's the case with the miners. For example, we know that they roost as a communal group every night, and they come back to the same place every night about the same time. They gather in the small groups first in different places, then they come back to their large group. And then at a particular signal from a scout or a lead bird, they'll go into the roost. And the same process happens in reverse in the morning. Now, if that process can be disrupted, if their gathering points can be made unattractive to them so that the groups get scattered, if the communication systems that pull them together at night can be disrupted, or even once they go in to their roost, if we can make it unattractive for them to be in that roost site, then they will move out. The problem is, of course, they have to go somewhere else then, so you need to be tracking them to know where they're going to settle next.
When you talk about making their roosting area unattractive, do you mean things like maybe putting smoke up through the trees or something like that?
Oh, it could be smoke, it could be noise, it could be other species being in there, it could be barriers to them getting in and out. One of the things that seems to be, at this stage, relatively early days of our research, but one thing that seems to be very important to them is visibility. They like to go into a roost site where they can see things coming and they can see for a reasonably long way, but you can't see them. So that's why they like the palm trees, because they can get right down in those fronds. They can see out, but you wouldn't have a clue that they were there. Sheds with internal guttering. They get into the sheds and get into the internal guttering. There's usually internal rafters that some birds can sit on and see out. Now, if you can block off that visibility, they're just not going to want to be there anymore. So it's things like that, understanding their processes and the way they view the world. What is important to us? What are the things that we absolutely need to make this an attractive place to be? And then taking that away, and they can hopefully decide that it's not the place to colonise. Or alternatively, they just won't breed at the same rate that they're breeding now.
I live in an area of Sydney where it's pretty leafy and tree. We've got a creek in the garden and so on. But just a few streets away up at the main highway, the place is littered with both feral pigeons and Indian miners, whereas in our part of the world, where we've got more trees, we have currawongs and lorikeets, the occasional noisy mining, but not a single Indian miner. Is it just the fact that we have more trees?
Absolutely. They don't like bush because they like to be able to see. They're more likely to be in that one big tree with mown grass all around it, which perhaps to the human mind they'll look at it and think, well, that's pretty exposed, you know, why would they want to be there? Where really it's exactly what they want.
Well, it seems as if Indian miners are an unsolved worldwide problem. How hopeful are you of positive outcomes for your research?
Our whole research project, I'm hoping, is positive, because we're looking at really targeting areas that either have not been invaded yet or have very low numbers, and looking at, as I say, why do they go into some areas and not others, and then coming up with ways of predicting where they will be and trapping them when the numbers are low, because that's where we've got the chance of really having an impact. And that's certainly a good possibility here in southeast Queensland and northern New South Wales, and I'm sure it's the case in other parts of the country as well. I know Western Australia have been very proactive in controlling minor numbers. Like any pest control issues, the earlier you take action, the better, and that's what we're trying to do up here, or at least gather the information that will allow agencies that do that sort of thing to act in confidence. Well, certainly we can make a difference.
Well, I hope so, and I hope you can do something for us down here in Sydney at some stage, but I think that's a long way down the track. Thank you very much indeed, Gail, for talking to us about ferals in the city, I suppose, this time.
Thanks very much.